Thank you, Kurt. The current crisis in the Catholic Church raises many questions about structure and change in the Church. One of the people who has long advocated for changes in the Church is Maryknoll priest Father Roy Bourgeois. Father Roy Bourgeois is the founder of the group SOA Watch, or School of the Americas Watch, and he has worked to close the school through nonviolent protests since the 1990s. He worked with the poor in Bolivia. He has also been involved in supporting many other human rights issues. In 2008, he delivered the homily at the ordination ceremony of a member of the Roman Catholic women priests, and he was threatened with excommunication after that. He continues to advocate for the ordination of women into the priesthood. He will be in Portland this week, this Friday evening, April 9th, as part of a national tour organized by the National Women's Ordination Conference. It's called Break the Silence, Shatter the Stained Glass Ceiling. That's at 7 p.m. at Central Lutheran Church at 1820 Northeast 21st Avenue. The evening's presentation is called A Journey of Conscience, Women Are Finding a Way. Father Roy Bourgeois, welcome to KBOO.
It's good to be with you, Kathleen.
Thank you. Let's start with what's in the news. Can you talk about your reaction to the child molestation and abuse and the mounting evidence for Pope Benedict's involvement in the cover-up?
Well, I must say this is a very difficult issue to be talking about, but I think it's necessary. This present week of Newsweek magazine, its issue, and along with USA Today, put it this way, that in the United States alone, over 10,000 children were sexually abused by over 4,000 Catholic priests. Again, as difficult it is to talk about such crimes against children and such a scandal in the Catholic Church that I'm a member of, I think it's necessary. It's something that we must do. I think what we have to talk about, first of all, is some church reform. I want to begin by saying it took me a while, but in my work in you know, addressing this injustice of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America with the focus on the U.S. Army School of the Americas, military school, where we train hundreds of Latin American soldiers with U.S. taxpayer money every year in the way of millions of dollars going into this program. In my work in this issue, I met many women over the years here at home talking about their call to priesthood. And I must say, at first, being a typical priest, I was saying, well, it's not our tradition. But I must say I had to give serious thought to what I was hearing from very devout Catholic women in our church who wanted to serve the church and being called to serve the church by God, you know, as priest. And what I've come to after much reflection in study and research is that what we have here is a grave injustice in the church, an injustice against women, an injustice against our church, and a very big injustice against God who calls women to the priesthood. And the more I researched it, what I found is that my church's teaching that excludes women from ordination cannot stand up to scrutiny. At the very core of that teaching is sexism. And what women are saying, and I concur, sexism is a sin. And like racism, it cannot be justified, no matter how hard our church leaders may try to justify discrimination. And in the end, it's wrong. And I've come to the conclusion, Kathleen, that, you know, I do firmly believe that if we had women priests, women bishops, that there would not have been those many years of cover-up. What we read about now is that these are not isolated cases. Many bishops and fellow priests, because I'm a Catholic priest, we were silent. Rather than protecting children from predator priests, from pedophiles, we were more interested in protecting the church from scandal. And therein lies a major problem. You know, in an all-male clergy, there's a culture there of, you know, protecting your own. I was in the military before I became a Catholic priest. I remember in Vietnam, you know, we were about protecting the image, you know, or for the military from scandal. It comes with, you know, with organizations. Cops do that. And, of course, we really do that as clergy. And what we have here are crimes against children done in the name of protecting the church from scandal. And, of course, that is inexcusable. And what we have now is a huge scandal, one big mess. And I don't know how we are going to get out of this, but I do know that there must be actions. There must be accountability. We must start breaking down this attitude that we as clergy and people like bishops and the Pope in Rome, that we and they answer only to God. We might think that's the way it works, but that's not the way it works in the world. We are human, we make mistakes, and we must own up to the crimes that we have committed in our church.
Are there others within the church that feel as you do and want to find some way to reform?
Without a doubt. First of all, I mean, in the women's ordination movement, I mean, this is a movement whose time has come. The polls are showing the majority of Catholics, many of them traditional Catholics, including my only family members in Louisiana, recently telling me that they believe, most Catholics express, that they want women priests and a married priesthood. A lot of the church is also in another crisis. Many, many churches are closing because of a shortage of priests. When I entered the Marino community, the seminary back in the 60s, we had over 300 seminarians preparing for the priesthood. Today we have 8, and there are many other orders in that same situation. I mean, we are going the way of the dinosaurs. And My sister, traditional Catholic, and friends who are Catholics, they say, well, you know, why are we closing 30 churches in New Orleans and elsewhere when we have many women who want to serve our church as priests or are being called by God to the priesthood? I mean, this is madness. What we have, of course, is a long tradition that's rooted in patriarchy, that's rooted in sexism. And I, unless we start ordaining women, the church is going to get into an ever-deepening crisis. Another situation, of course, is the issue of accountability. We don't have in the church a structure where clergy and bishops are accountable to others rather than just the Pope, or accountable only to God. I must say this, I feel, though, that in this women's ordination movement, it's like the women's suffrage movement. There was a lot of resistance, but it couldn't be stopped. It couldn't be. The civil rights movement couldn't be stopped. There were many. I grew up in the South, you know, and we use that word tradition to justify our segregated schools, even in my little Catholic church where I attended. You know, it was the tradition for the last 5 pews to be reserved for our black members. And the church keeps using that word tradition. It is our tradition that only males can be ordained. Well, that's not accurate, you see. And it's not what we've got here is a justice issue. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced, I feel hopeful, because I know that good will come from this. One thing we're realizing is that Catholics are saying this. We have put too much trust in our clergy, in our Pope, in our priests, in our bishops. Our trust should be put in God. What we're learning is that it's just not healthy to the way we have related to priests in the past, putting them on pedestals. And many, many clergy, you know, have this attitude, sort of a holier-than-thou attitude. Well, what's going on in the church today, I must say, it's rocking the institution at its very core. And out of that, I believe, will come a much healthier attitude toward church and what we can expect from church leaders, and, of course, a deeper faith in a loving God.
And the response within the church, for instance, the response of the cardinal this past weekend to defend the Pope and also to criticize the press for, I think, gossip mongering or some term like that. How do you think that is seen within the community of Catholics and within the people who are sort of in positions of power? Do you think they align with that, or do you think there's enough of a critique of that these days that there would be some movement for reform?
That's very important, I think, to bring this up, Kathleen. There are some, I think they're in a real very, very small minority, who believe that this is an attempt to smear the Pope, to bring the Pope down. But the vast majority of Catholics that I know and other people of faith, I mean, they are very upset, very angry. It adds to the scandal when you hear a top Vatican official say that this is an attempt to discredit the Pope, that this is all about the Pope, that this is really about petty gossip. Well, I mean, when you think about, you know, over 10,000 children in the United States alone, along with thousands who have been abused by Catholic priests in Germany, the Netherlands, Austria, Australia, and other countries that we'll be reading about, this is not petty gossip. And this, I must say, is so offensive to the victims. And no, this is not about Pope Benedict. This is about the victims who have been traumatized, who today are trying to recover and live lives, you know, as a result of being abused by others. Now, I don't know what to say other than the Pope has a problem, because when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, who he headed the Vatican office, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Church, in May of 2001, in that position as head of the Vatican office, dealing with all of these thousands of cases coming to his office, dealing with allegations of sexual abuse by clergy in the United States mainly. And he sent this letter, May of 2001, to all bishops around the world, including in the U.S., stating that those cases were to be treated with secrecy by the Vatican, that they, as bishops, were not to go to the media or to civil authorities, to the police. And therein lies a very, very major problem. He received, they're documenting this now, you know, the priest from Wisconsin, the priest from Tucson, Arizona, where it was documented. There were hundreds of allegations, you know, children that these priests had abused. And he sat on those cases for years, 1-7 years, where a bishop had written to him, to Cardinal Ratzinger, pleading with him to defrock this priest immediately because he was abusing children in a confessional. That case took over 7 years, along with others. And now we're reading the head of the Vatican office dealing with these cases, Cardinal Laveda, who was the Archbishop of Portland for years. When he was there, there were cases involved where he had transferred priests to other dioceses, other churches, where their crimes were not known. And now he is the head of this Vatican office dealing with these cases of sexual abuse by clergy. I might say, too, it really angered me to read about this now, how long it's taking that office to respond to these crimes done against children by clergy. When I attended the ordination of a woman in Lexington, Kentucky, less than 3 months, I received a letter from that Vatican office, now headed by Cardinal Laveda, that said, and it was signed by him, it listed the canon laws that I violated. It talked about how I caused scandal, in their words, in the church. And I had 30 days to recant my belief in public statements that support the ordination of women, or I will be automatically excommunicated. Less than 3 months, I received that letter. They were aggressive, it was severe, and they acted swiftly. But in thousands of cases that they received dealing with crimes against children by clergy, sexual abuse cases, it took years and years, some of those cases 12 years, and they still didn't act. And what this says to me, you know, what their priorities are all about. And I must say, there's got to be some very big changes made in the Vatican, made in the Catholic Church. And one of the things that we have to start doing is ordaining women. We must have also a married clergy. It's just not healthy for any organization to have one gender dominated that organization. And the Catholic Church is dominated by males, by only men can be leaders in the church, can be ordained, can be bishops, can be a pope. That is not healthy.
I'm speaking with Father Roy Bourgeois. He is the founder of the group SOA Watch, or School of the Americas Watch. He is going to be in Portland this Friday evening, April 9th. He's speaking as part of a tour called Break the Silence, Shatter the Stained Glass Ceiling. He's speaking at 7 p.m. at Central Lutheran Church. That's at 1820 Northeast 21st Avenue. And Father Roy, I wanted to ask you about the status of your own excommunication. What was the follow-up on that? Are you considered excommunicated?
Well, that's the question. After receiving that letter, I took 2 weeks. I went on retreat and just prayed about what I had to do and reflected. And I wrote back a letter to the Vatican, which will be available when I'm giving that talk in Portland. Exactly the letter, a copy of the letter that I wrote. Basically, what it said was that, in conscience, I could not recant. And I gave my reasons why the church's teaching, excluding women from ordination, simply cannot stand up to scrutiny. But I did say that conscience, we've always been taught that as Catholics, conscience is very sacred. We talked about it as the primacy of conscience. Conscience is our lifeline to God. When we follow our conscience, we're very free, we're at peace. When we violate our consciences, and we've all been there, we are tormented. We do things that we know are not right, are not moral, and we are tormented. And I said in conscience, I could not recant my belief in public statements that call for the ordination of women in our church. What we have here is an injustice. And basically what we also say, I said in the letter, excluding women from ordination implies that men are superior and women are inferior. And, of course, the sexual abuse scandal, I think, addresses this issue of, worthiness, that males are worthy to be priests and women are not. I sent my letter saying in conscience I could not recant. I have not got any acknowledgement of receipt of my letter. They did not respond to what I brought up in the letter, especially that issue of conscience. So I've consulted bishop friends, canon lawyers, and I've been advised to continue my ministry as before. I do realize that I'm not in good standing, I'm sure, right now with the Vatican on this issue, but what's most important, I think, is to be in good standing with my God. I continue to be a member of my Marino community, continuing my ministry as before, giving many, many talks on the School of the Americas issue, and also receiving many invitations and talking on this issue of women's ordination. I just want to also add, while I'm thinking about it, for those listeners who want more information, on the issue of the School of the Americas in this whole issue of militarism in Latin America and what we've been doing on that issue. We've got a grassroots movement of tens of thousands of people, many from Portland, also Seattle, where I'll be speaking. But, you know, we bring out 10, 20,000 people here, the main gate of Fort Benning, each November to call for the school's closing. There are college students, lots of nuns, military veterans, senior citizens, parents with their children, and they're all part of the SOA Watch movement. And for more information on that issue, our listeners can simply go to our website, soaw.org. That's soaw.org. And more information, of course, on the women's ordination issue. There's a very good website, Roman Catholic Women Priest.org.
Great. I wanted to ask you in the few minutes that we have left just about the issue of power, because it seems like possibly both the issue of child abuse and the issue of sexism are about power. When I was mentioning this issue to someone, especially the issue of celibacy within the priesthood, they said that, oh, it's not about sex, it's about power. And I wondered if I could get your thoughts on that.
Without a doubt. I mean, I you know, my teachers are women in the church. They are at the vanguard of this movement, as they were the leaders in the women's suffrage movement and other movements. And they have reminded me, as a Catholic priest, that what's at the core of this issue of patriarchy and excluding women from ordination is the issue of power. We as men don't want to give up that power, you know, in Rome, you know, as church leaders. And I see that. I mean, I see the priest in my little hometown. He's overworked. He's overwhelmed. He's got two churches to attend to with all these masses, you know, 2,000 Catholics in that area. And rather than welcoming, you know, a woman priest so he can take a weekend off and go fishing or whatever, just have some leisure time. Rather, he doesn't want to give up the pulpit. He doesn't want to give up his power. He's addicted to the power. And I see this power as an addiction in the Catholic Church. Power can become very addictive. But the problem is we can't hold on to it as much as we want to. And there will never be a vibrant and healthy church until women can be ordained, until men give up that power. And I must say, this is the sin of the church. It's not about power. This man Jesus said, look, if you want to be first, if you want to be powerful, no, go to the back of the line. It's all about serving others. It's all about healing the suffering of the poor, of standing up for justice and peace. And right now, the problem is that issue of power, as you mentioned. It's at the very core of what's wrong with the church today. But, you know, what I've learned in Latin America, Kathleen, is this issue of power, that those who have the power will not, out of the goodness of their heart, give it up. It must be taken away. I mean, as strange as it is, then we don't want to won't give up our power freely. There is a movement in Latin America, they are the poor, bringing about change, telling their dictators and those with the power, you know, you've got to give it up. And in the church, there's change will come from the bottom up, not from the top down. And what we need, of course, are new models of church that's less top-down, where this small group, especially in Rome, of men, they claim ownership to the church. They, as men, and that's what patriarchy is all about, men claim this divine right to know the will of God. And what people are saying in the Catholic Church, lay people, women especially, and men, saying, no, you do not own the church. You do not have the keys to the kingdom. You are like us. No one has a monopoly of the truth. And so what we have here is a movement at work in the Catholic Church, as their social justice movements in Latin America, addressing this issue of power. And of course, Rome will have to give up that power that they possess. And what we will never have a healthy and vibrant church until we have, I think, women priests, women bishops, and one day, I do believe, a woman pope.
Father Roy, I want to thank you so much for speaking about this. I want to let people know again the websites that you mentioned. SOAW.org is the website for School of America's Watch. Am I right on that
yes.
one? And the other one was RomanCatholicChurch.org. Org? Was that right?
Yeah, that was Roman Catholic Women Priests.org.
Oh, okay.
And I would really invite our listeners to come to the talk there on Friday. That's Friday evening at 7 p.m. at the Lutheran Church. I would love to see you there. I'll speak for about a half hour, and there'll be some good time for discussion.
Great. Okay, Father Roy Bourgeois speaking to us before his event in Portland this Friday night, 7 p.m., Central Lutheran Church, 1820 Northeast 21st Avenue. It's called A Journey of Conscience, Women Are Finding a Way. Father Roy, thanks again.
Thank you, and also there'll be women on the panel that evening who will also be speaking, Tony, Laurie, Sandra, and others.
Great. Okay, thank you so much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KABU. Stay tuned. Coming up, it's Per Fogering. He's going to be talking with Sharon Newman about theories about the end of the world.
KABU is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility's annual awards dinner with keynote speaker Dar Jamil. He's an independent journalist and author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. The dinner will be on April 10th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Oregon Zoo. For more info, kboo.fm/OPSR.
Yo, yatahe, and hello. This is
Red Willow,
Samantha King,
and Louis Sowa.
When we invite you to listen on April 2nd, Friday, and April 16th, Friday, from 1:30 to 3 p.m. to our new Native American show called Indian Country. We will be offering music, powwow information, current events, and other items of interest related to our listening community.
Please join us on April 2nd and April 16th, both Fridays at 1:30, for our first and second show of Indian Country. Wado and thank you. Again, this is Red Willow,
Samantha King,
and Louis Sowa.
We're looking forward to being with you again.
Certainly are.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is now 9:31 as we continue with Political Perspectives with Per Fogering.
Well, good morning. Our topic today is the real history of the end of the world. I have to say that last announcement looked like we heard the trumpet of doom. Anyway, our guest is Sharon Newman, who is the author of a series of books, The Real History. One is The Real History Behind the Da Vinci Code, The Real History Behind the Templars, and now The Real History of the End of the World. Sharon Newman, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Oh, welcome to KABU.
Thank you.
Well, it's a very interesting book. It's got a lot of covers about, up to 40 different end of the world scenarios. And sort of like a brief, compendium of all these. Maybe we should start with the earliest one. The earliest one that I found was the Great Flood narrative.
Right, basically from Gilgamesh. And what I did with the book was I started, it's basically chronological, and I started with the oldest chronicle I could find on the destruction of all humanity, which seems to be the universal flood myth. And so for some societies, such as the ancient Babylonians, they didn't worry so much about the end of the world because for them it had already happened, and they were the new world.
Mm. And what did they do with it? What did they do with it?
What everybody else does.
Uh-huh. Well, some of the ones that most people know about, you know, they sort of relate to us. One is the Book of Revelation by John of Patmos. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, Revelation is certainly one of the books of the Bible that has had the most influence on apocalyptic and end-of-the-world thought. And, of course, John is based on a revelation or an apocalypse, but it's also based on several of the earlier Old Testament books, Isaiah and Daniel and the prophets, other prophets, on how they think God will end the world. And, of course, the thing about the Book of Revelations is it's so enigmatic that it can be interpreted to fit just about every occasion.
Well, you know, I had a friend from high school days who kind of became a Jesus person, and I remember one time we were talking, he told me that the Book of Revelation predicted helicopters. And I said, well, you show me where. Well, he pointed out some chapter about scorpions with stinging tails or something like that that he thought meant helicopters. But from what I've been reading, apparently was the Book of Revelation intended as a prediction or what? Some say it's sort of like a take heart call to the Christian early Christians.
Well, it was addressed to seven churches in Asia Minor, and it was certainly written during a time of persecution and disbelief and also a lot of infighting among the first churches. And so it was written in some ways to say, you know, hold fast, hang tight, you're going to get your reward in the end. And also all the bad guys are going to get theirs.
And it seems to be a lot of symbolism. You know, when you read this, and it seems to go on and on, just when you think, you know, there's going to be some kind of a climax, on we go to another bunch of weird-looking beasts.
Well, that is the problem with visions. They don't have a good plot line.
But I don't know. Are these animals symbolic or what? I've heard that the number 666 refers to the Emperor Nero.
Well, that's the main theory now. That mm-hmm. This was written during the time of Nero, who was, of course, a persecutor of Christians, and that through Greek and Hebrew numerology, basically Greek, his name came out to 666. But, of course, other people say Ronald Reagan, and I kind of like that one, too.
Oh, dear. Well, there's been a lot of, of course, now they're calling, some people are calling Barack Obama the Antichrist.
I find that very interesting. I know Hal Lindsey has done that, and he's recently backed off from that statement, but there are people, the Antichrist, Revelation doesn't go on much about the Antichrist. It's a lot of later traditions that make the Antichrist someone who's suave and persuasive and seems to be a very good person and who then takes over the world. And so, again, the Antichrist can fit just about anybody. And in my book, the Antichrist sort of dances through it because everybody finds the Antichrist somewhere.
Well, it's a strange plot line. I mean, like, somewhere in there, Satan is kind of imprisoned for 1,000 years, but then they let him go, and I wonder, why let him go?
Well, you know, the mind of God is not something we can fathom.
I see. Mm-hmm. Sort of trying him out on parole or something, and, like, maybe he'll shape up or what? But no, God is infallible, so God would know that Satan is never going to shape up.
Right. It's an interesting sort of philosophical, theological quandary, and certainly people have debated it for millennia. But somehow I don't think we can fit it all into one program.
So, and as you point out in your book, the book of Revelation was not sort of considered part of the Bible until a couple centuries after in the Common Era. Is that right?
Right. A lot of people thought it was heretical. A lot of people thought it was perhaps written under the influence of drugs. Mm. There were definitely people who decided that it wasn't part of the shouldn't be part of the Bible. Most people knew that it was not John the Evangelist who wrote it, that it was another John.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another thing. They just felt that it was too late to be part of the Bible.
And I think was Augustine one of the detractors?
He wasn't certain about it.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time of Augustine, it was in most of the Bibles. So, you know, the Bible itself didn't the New Testament wasn't completed until the 4th or 5th century in terms of deciding what books. And there are still old Bibles around. I mean, ancient Bibles around that have left out certain parts and put in others.
Well, now when Constantine became a Christian, and he was the one who didn't he convene this council at Nicaea?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
he did. And there they sort of the church fathers hashed things out and tried to present a unified church. Is that where they decided what books were in and what weren't?
No, that it was over 100 years later.
Oh.
That they actually made up a list. At Nicaea, they were just trying to decide what was Christian and what wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I've read about it, it was sort of like Congress on a bad day. A lot of yelling. We're used to thinking of these church fathers men with long white beards and so forth. These guys, a lot of them were in their 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And they were real rabble-rousers and very, very married to their own opinions about what the church should be.
And weren't some of them declared heretics, or did that come later also?
Oh, well, it came all the time. Anybody mm-hmm. who doesn't agree with you has to be a heretic.
Well, I mean, it's sort of there was an official designation or something like that.
Yes, the Arians were. It had to do with the nature of Christ, mm-hmm. whether he was human, not human, or partly human and partly divine. And actually, in my Da Vinci Code book, I have quite a bit on that because Dan Brown talked about it in the Da Vinci Code.
Well, you know, the Arian heresy, I've always found that kind of interesting. We should warn our listeners, it has nothing to do with the so-called Arian race. This comes from Bishop Arius.
Arius, yes.
Yes, and so it's named after Bishop Arius. And he basically said that Jesus was kind of a prophet, but was not a divine person. Is that correct?
No. Arius had a dual nature.
Oh, okay.
Idea. So that he, actually, that's kind of in the Da Vinci Code book too, but,
mm-hmm.
Arius, felt that Jesus was, all divine and that there was no actual suffering on the cross.
Really? Okay. But he was not God. Is that the distinction?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He definitely believed that.
Oh, really?
All of them believed that. It was just what part of it? It's, as I say, this is really a very long and entailed thing. I should probably start mm-hmm. set up a whole different lecture on that.
I guess this whole idea of the Trinity and all that, it's just, well, what they say is
right.
very
it's,
mysterious.
It's pretty far from the end of the world, and it's really not
yeah.
in the book.
Well, let's go on. You know, another end-of-the-world scenario that has a lot of people thinking now is the one about the Maya, and they supposedly predicted the end of the world in the year 2012.
Oh, yes. Now, that I did spend a lot of time on.
Mm-hmm.
Because especially tabloids, a lot of pop history books, which are really not history, and, of course, tons of documentaries have talked about this. And from what I have researched and the people whom I've talked to who are Mayan scholars, there is one segment of ancient Mayan society for whom the calendar did end on December 21st, 2012. But nobody really knows what they expected to come afterwards. There's nothing that says the world will end. It just says the calendar does. Other segments of Mayan society have calendars that flip over to the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually non-Mayans who are looking for apocalyptic theories, who have picked this up, not understanding it very well, and taken it and run. And made a lot of money, I understand.
Oh, I would think so, yes. Well, actually, the Mayans, I mean, they did sort of live through the collapse of their society.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't mean the end of people. They just kind of drifted off, and, you know, they're still around in Guatemala and southern Mexico.
Exactly, that's right. So the Maya people themselves have, but this 2012 thing, I think one of the most interesting things about it is that a whole lot of other inaccurate or semi-accurate statements have been marshaled to convince people that a lot of prophets, scientists, the world in general has signs that the world will end in 2012. So that there are a whole lot of opinions. There are people who've said that the I Ching has predicted it, that Nostradamus predicted it, which is not true. And over again, there's the galactic rift and other sort of astrological things. And so in the book, I look at all of these to try to separate them and explain what they really mean.
Well, why don't we go? One of the very interesting observations you made in the book was that the Middle Ages. Now, you are sort of a scholar of the Middle Ages.
I am.
And you mentioned there was a kind of an optimistic period, and this is back to, I don't know, are you familiar with Terry Jones?
Oh yes, of course.
He sort of
I've met him a couple of times.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he wrote one or two books about the Middle Ages. He sort of thought that the Renaissance was very much overrated.
Oh, I don't even believe in the Renaissance.
Well, that's interesting.
Any group that names themselves are suspect.
Yeah, well, of course, Terry Jones said it was kind of a lot of propaganda against the Middle Ages, that they weren't superstitious and everything. They knew the world was round. And,
oh, yes.
And in your book, you described another pretty optimistic period, in fact, that they didn't really have very many end-of-the-world scenarios, and that they sort of reappeared after the Black Plague, and that kind of
pretty
ended.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. And actually, the plague years in the 15th century were pretty much considered the start of the Renaissance. I mean, this is Boccaccio, mm-hmm. The beginnings of the Renaissance art and so forth. But it is true that there was a lot of writing and talking about the apocalypse in terms of religion and a lot of theories about it. But there wasn't the sense that the world was going to end anytime soon. They mm-hmm. said, oh, we're living in the last days, but we've still got 1,000 years to go at least. And there wasn't a lot of this until the Joachim of Fiore came along in the 13th century. And he was sort of an anomaly right there. But there weren't any attempts to set the date mm-hmm. or anything like that. Because in the High Middle Ages, from about the year 1000 to the year 1300, there was a good climate. There was a lot of, basically, people were well-fed in general. There weren't the sweeping plagues that there had been before. A lot of new towns were established. There was time for art and so forth. So it was an optimistic time.
Mm-hmm. I might mention for our listeners that Terry Jones was one of the members of the Monty Python troupe, and he later became a film director, and he wrote several books, including books about the Middle Ages. And
oh, yes. He comes to the medieval conferences sometimes.
Oh, really? What's he like?
Oh, he's sweet. Put on a little weight, but haven't we all? And he does know his stuff. He gives some proper academic papers, mostly on Chaucer, which is a particular area of his. But he's a very nice man.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me throw in another book that sort of relates to this. It's a generally considered science fiction, although it's not. It's A Canticle for Leibowitz. Are you familiar with that book?
I know it, but I haven't read it. It's one of those things that I should have read in college and somehow passed on.
It's become a kind of an underground classic, but it's it starts out with a new atomic. There's been an atomic war. This book was written back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And starts out with a new dark age, and then it proceeds. Leibowitz was an atomic scientist who was murdered by the survivors of this nuclear war. And this monastery in the Southwest, they sort of have the idea that he is a saint. They want to get him, made a saint. And so they collect his relics and things like that. This monastery is sort of kind of like in the early Middle Ages, where the monastery sort of treasured any little scrap of information or knowledge. And then it goes from the Dark Age to a new Renaissance, and then it goes to a new Atomic Age, like this cycle is going around again, you know. And it's when I first read that book, I thought, gee, was of those three ages, the one that seemed the most congenial was the Dark Age. You know, it was kind of brutal in some ways, but it was simple. And, the new Renaissance, I mean, with these really bloody-minded dictators, and, of course, a new Atomic Age is a disaster, a nightmare.
Right. And, of course, a lot of those books that were written in the 50s were a response to the development of the atom bomb. And in the book, I make the point that actually from about the 17th century on, each century has been more and more apocalyptically minded until the late 20th century. It became, because we realized that we could actually destroy ourselves without help from anybody, people have become much more fearful today than they were 1,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You go ahead.
Oh, I said, and so that's why I spend a lot of time on the later centuries, the ones in the 19th and the 20th century particularly, because there were so many where people really believed and set a date for the end.
Mm-hmm. And they were invariably disappointed.
So far?
So far. Well, now we have, the supposedly rational age, we still have a lot of people believing or saying they believe that Jesus is coming back, but he won't come back until Israel is sort of reunited. They have a new temple built in Israel and so forth and so on. And then, of course, these are the Christian Zionists who are saying this, and they somehow expect that once Jesus comes, all the Jews will convert to Christianity.
Yes, I have a chapter on that, too, although that idea has been going for a long time. And mm-hmm. there have been times where, such as during the Crusades, occasionally there were rumors that Jews were all running to Israel, actually after the Crusades, sorry, the Jews were going to Israel in order to convert and to be ready for Armageddon. But that seems to be definitely the idea now, and as I said, I have a chapter on that, on the ways that that the Christian Zionists have supported Israel and are actually among the most militant people about retaking the East Bank and the West Bank and so forth, and also for raising the Dome of the Rock and building a temple.
Mm.
So in a lot of ways, they're instigators for war in the Middle East.
Very dangerous, too, in these times. But
scares me.
Apparently, Jewish Zionists have mixed feelings about these people.
Oh, yes, many of them do. And, there are levels of Jewish Zionism, too. I know many Israelis who think that they're crazy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's another little, I suppose, a part of the Christian Zionist movement. There's some prophecy or something about the end will not come until a perfect red heifer is found. Have you heard that one?
That's part of Jewish tradition.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Again, it's not in the Bible. It's It's not even in the Talmud. It's simply part of a folk tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they do go on. It's sort of like there's the Sioux, I believe, tradition about a pure white buffalo being born that will signal a time for the Sioux people to regain their land. It's, you know, who knows? I'm not denying any of these things. I'm just saying I'm a reporter on this case. Mm-hmm. I just say this is what people have believed. And in some cases, I do have problems with some of the things like the Bible code and the things that people attribute to Nostradamus, because what they're saying is simply not in the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But as for things that are faith, well, you can't deny faith. The whole point of religion is to believe in something without proof.
It's pretty hard to debate it, right?
Right. So I don't debate it. I say this is what mm-hmm. people believe. And, you know, if any of these things happen, I'll be surprised, but mm-hmm. it's still not something that I'm saying that can't happen, because it's outside of evidence. It's outside of science. It's faith.
Well, apparently there's some guy in Alabama, I believe, who's trying to, he's a farmer, and he's trying to raise a perfect heifer. In other words, that's a cow that has all red hairs, not one non-red hair on its body. And so I guess it's a pretty difficult thing to do.
Yes, and I think he's not the first one to try.
Okay. Well, I really have to say something about the rapture. Because mm-hmm. this is another. It just seems when I read about the rapture, I think of all these kind of naked Christians floating around in the air, and it just seems like a very strange theory. How did that come about?
It actually started with St. Paul's letter to the Thessalonians,
really?
Where he says
mm-hmm.
that this is what will happen mm-hmm. to the believers. So it's not, again, it has biblical roots, and in my research on it, because I was one of those who sort of made fun of the rapture, and I do a little bit in this book too. Really, it seems to me that the idea of the rapture makes as much sense as any other theory, and also that the people who began it were also began the idea. John Knox Darby was extremely active in social movements in charities and so forth. So he wasn't just distancing himself from those who weren't saved.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very surprised by what I found. I'm not saying that I believe in the rapture any more than I believe in anything else, but I don't think it's any more irrational than believing in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I did come across one sort of scenario, not for the end of the world, but a huge catastrophe, and it involves on the Canary Islands, on the Isle of La Palma, there is this mountain called La Cumbre Vieja. And scientists say that the next time a volcano happens there, that half this mountain will kind of fall into the sea, and it'll start a tremendous tsunami. The tsunami will be over 300 feet high, the wave, you know, hitting West Africa, and then it'll travel across the Atlantic, and by the time it gets to the Atlantic seaboard, it'll only be 50 feet high, but that's enough to really wipe out most of the towns along the Atlantic coast.
Well, I've heard that one too, and again, it's based, I don't think any scientist said this will happen. Scientists don't say that.
Mm-hmm.
They would say, if these variables occur, this could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm sure it's possible, but there are things like with this brand new earthquake in Sumatra, everyone was terrified there would be another tsunami, and it's actually caused very little damage. So scientists know that there is just too much to be certain of what's going to happen. It's when the tabloids get hold of it, they find the worst possible scenario and then say, science says this will happen.
Mm. Well, I read about this mostly in some of the English papers, the Daily Mail and the Independent, and
yeah.
I think what they're saying is that, well, the Daily Mail is sort of a tabloid, I believe. The Independent is a pretty respectable newspaper.
Yes, it is.
But
they're not immune to mm-hmm. to sensationalism to sell papers.
I think what they're saying, though, is that this mountain is very unstable, that this the half is very precarious, and that it would not take a whole lot to split the mountain in half or whatever.
Well, you know, if that happens, mm-hmm. then I guess New York had better learn how to dog paddle.
Oh, boy.
it's not the sort of thing that, I'm not saying it won't happen. I'm mm-hmm. just saying that we right. need to put these things in perspective and look at the real possibilities.
Well, we are talking with Sharon Newman, who has written a book on the real history of the end of the world, and she will be appearing, I think it's Tuesday the 13th, at Powell's Books in Beaverton. That's the Cedar Hill Crossing. It's
right.
It's in that shopping center on Cedar Hills Boulevard and Walker Road. And that will be next Tuesday, I believe, it's 7 o'clock?
Right.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll also be signing at Annie Bloom's in Multnomah Village on Thursday at 7:30.
Oh, I see. That's the Thursday after the next Tuesday.
Right. So if you miss me Tuesday, you can always come on Thursday and ask me more questions.
Well, do you have any more books in store? What are you working on now?
Right now, I'm working on, I'm trying to get back to writing novels, which is mm-hmm. something I enjoy. But I'm also working on a book on women and power, which is, again, another thing that has been misunderstood throughout the centuries. So I sort of fell into this with the Da Vinci Code, but I seem to be kind of a mythbuster.
Uh-huh.
I need to get the right kind of hat. Mythbusters must have special headgear, and I don't.
Maybe something with a light, like a miner's hat with a light shining off of it.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with Sharon Newman, the author of The Real History of the End of the World, Cedar Hill Crossing, Powell's out in Beaverton next Tuesday. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And now stay tuned because Air Cascadia is coming up.